Now, maybe you've seen it, maybe you haven't. Maybe you're just sick and tired of all the controversy surrounding the release of the Da Vinci Code film this past weekend. But my regular guest on our View from Westminster certainly gives it the thumbs down and suggests you take a pillow or a magazine to help you through the 2.5-hour showing.
I read the book. I thought the book was very exciting and really gripping. I can tell you the film is dull, dull, dull. It's like listening to a long, tedious history lecture by batty professor in a dusty church, you know, relieved only by this sort of assaults by this pastiche, Python-esque, blood-covered monk.
Austin Ivory is Director of Public Affairs for the Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, who's been in and out of hospital these past few weeks. He's also been raising some important concerns with the Muslim community in Britain, urging them to speak out more strongly against violence and religious oppression in Islamic countries. Let's find out more. Austin, thank you very much for joining us on the programme
again.
Nice
to be with you again.
Could you start off, perhaps, by telling us a little bit about the health of Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, because those who read the Catholic press regularly will know that he's been in hospital again, and this is the second time in as many months, isn't it? So there's a bit of concern as to whether he's suffering from anything serious or long-term.
Well, I can tell you he's fine at the moment. He was out of hospital on Sunday. He's still taking it easy because he had an infection last week in his leg, which is what took him into hospital. They had to give him antibiotics. The infection is now cleared. It does seem to be part of the same problem as before Easter, namely to do with circulation, and he's a very tall man in his 70s, and apparently this is very common. He does lead, I have to say, a pretty frenetic life and does lots of short trips, short flights, and the advice of his doctors is he really needs to cut back on some of those. So he is going to be this year having fewer flights, giving himself more chance to rest between flights. But there's nothing serious.
Well, that's indeed very good news. This past week, he made an important speech, didn't he, about Catholic-Muslim relations in Britain. It was a speech at the Oxford Centre for Islamic Studies, and it raised a few eyebrows, I understand.
It raised a few eyebrows because the Cardinal, I suppose the heart of what he was saying, or the bit that at least was picked up by the press, was that he called for reciprocity in Muslim-Christian relations. And that's to say Christians should stand alongside Muslims, defend their rights, their religious freedoms, and stand up for them against Islamophobia, as the Cardinal has been doing very much, and particularly since the attacks of 7th of July last year. And he was also saying that Muslims in Britain need also to care where Christians, for example, are being denied their religious rights and their freedoms in countries around the world.
It was an interesting speech talking about the things that unite Muslims and Christians, but also the things that divide them. It was quite a profound theological speech, wasn't it?
Well, it was making clear that because Catholics and Muslims don't agree on aspects of theology, I mean, as you know, monotheism is one of the big dividing points between Catholics and Christians, indeed, and Muslims, that Muslims don't recognise Christians as properly monotheistic because of our Trinitarian theology. And, of course, there are exclusive claims on both sides. The Muslims believe that the Prophet Muhammad and the Quran is, you know, the way to salvation. And, of course, we say the same. Jesus is the truth, the way, the life, the truth. Because both of them have what can appear to be very exclusive claims, and because they don't agree theologically, that does not prevent them having deep respect for each other, a close relations at a human level, and to be together indeed at a religious level, and to form ever closer bonds. There is no contradiction between those two things, he was saying. And in fact, the two faiths, of course, have always been close neighbours. I mean, he said Medina and Mecca, you know, are not so far away from Jerusalem and Bethlehem. He used that as a metaphor to say we've always been alongside each other, and that there are traditions, I mean, in both of our scriptures, both in the Bible, particularly the New Testament, and also the Quran, which call for a profound, respectful dialogue with people of other faiths.
There are also some interesting comparisons between the suspicion, the rejection perhaps, of Muslims in British society today, and the same treatment of Catholics just really a few decades ago.
Yeah, he did say to, he said that here we are, he was speaking, of course, as a Catholic cardinal in the ancient medieval University of Oxford, which, as we know, was founded by, the colleges were, cloisters of monks until the Reformation. And he said rather wryly that when Catholics, you know, were allowed back into Oxford, they were regarded by those in Oxford as newcomers. But, you know, looking around at these ancient cloisters, they could be forgiven for thinking that term was not quite accurate. And he was saying, you know, you Muslims, now in this very distinguished Centre for Islamic Studies in Oxford, which was founded a few years ago, he said, people might think of you as newcomers, but look at everything that Muslims have contributed to the university tradition, to science, to scholarship. Indeed, where would Western universities be without that great Arab tradition of science and so on? So he was, if you like, bonding with our Muslim brothers and sisters on that. And then, of course, also the place of Muslims in British society is a relatively novel one, that they have that presence. And, of course, the suspicion is often that they're, you know, not quite English, not quite belong. And that was the same suspicion directed, of course, at Catholics really up until very recently in Britain.
But as you say, at the heart of this speech was really a call, an appeal to Muslim leaders in Britain to speak out more strongly against violence, wherever that takes place, violence on the part of Islamic extremists, to speak out more strongly in defence of people of all different religions as well. What kind of reaction have you had to that?
Well, an interesting reaction. We've had a number of reactions from Muslims in Britain who have been saying, yes, the Cardinal is absolutely right. We're far too timid in speaking out when religious rights are violated in Muslim countries. Some have said these comments are not welcome at this time because of Afghanistan and Iraq and Guantanamo Bay, to which, of course, I've been responding on various discussion programmes. Look, these are, you know, respect for religion is an eternal, and religious rights and religious freedoms, these are eternal matters, fundamental matters, and can't be contingent on whatever is happening politically, because we are talking here about a religious relationship between two religious communities, which need to be conducted on the basis of the mutual defence of each other's rights. This forms part, Philippa, of a discourse, if I can call it that, of the Cardinal's that he's been having really since 7th of July, and which was defined at the Sant'Egidio meeting of world religious leaders in September last year in Lyon as a spiritual humanism of peace. And by this, the Cardinal means that people of religion, of faith, need to stand together in support of each other, in mutual respect for each other, because there is a religious humanism, and we are human beings, first of all, we are spiritual beings, and it is on that basis that we need to construct peace. And that means speaking out against, for example, God being blasphemed by being dragged into justifying violence, for example. You know, we need to have a consistent discourse in this country on the part of all religious leaders against violence being associated with religion, against fundamentalism, and in favour of each other's rights. It's a very important idea of his, which I think he's been developing a lot this last year.
Now, just when most of us never want to hear the words Da Vinci Code again, I know you've been dealing with almost nothing else, haven't you, over the past few days since the film was released. You've been helping coordinate, of course, the Catholic Church's response there in Britain. And you've got a few interesting observations regarding more generally religious life and values and how to witness to those in our contemporary society.
We're all really sick of the Da Vinci Code. In fact, I have been even before the film was coming up. But I have to tell you, it's been very, very interesting these last few weeks being coordinator of what we call the Da Vinci Code Response Group, which is, I ought to make clear, not an official body of the Catholic Church. It's an ad hoc group of theologians, and we've got a Benedictine abbot, some suspiciously telegenic members of Opus Dei, a great little group. And we've been meeting, we've been making ourselves available for interview in the media, and we've been solidly pointing out, consistently pointing out, the dishonesty at the heart of the marketing strategy of Sony Pictures, which is, and Dan Brown, which is to claim in some way that the Da Vinci Code is based on respectable theories and on facts. So we've been plugging that home. We commissioned a very interesting survey last weekend, which showed that if you've read the Da Vinci Code, you're twice as likely to believe that the Catholic Church has covered up the truth about Jesus Christ, and four times more likely to believe that Opus Dei has committed murder. So it's quite wrong to say it's just fiction and everybody should treat it like that. I mean, that's the right way. That is the right thing to say. But many people are taken in by its claims and have their beliefs affected. So I don't know whether you caught Ian McKellen, who plays Sir Lee Teabing in the film, was asked whether as we've been calling for, there should be a disclaimer at the beginning of the film making clear it's fiction. And he says, well, why? You don't need it. The Bible, he said, should have a disclaimer at the beginning of it, because who believes that, you know, people walk on water? Now, I've noticed this a lot in these discussions, as if to say, well, look, we don't really take the Da Vinci Code claims seriously, but, you know, it's just a story, and after all, Christianity is just a story, isn't it? Now, it seems to me that on the one hand, this looks like postmodern playfulness, but it's not. It's actually a very cynical marketing strategy on the part of Sony Pictures and on the part of Dan Brown to sort of claim that really, well, there is no truth out there. And you can go onto the website, you know, of the Da Vinci Code film, and you can have a discussion about the relative merits of these completely kooky Holy Blood, Holy Grail theories that were rubbished in the 1980s by serious scholars. And they're trying to raise these to the level of 2,000 years of scholarship and Christian tradition. No, 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 we've been saying, you can't do that. There is such a thing as truth. There is such a thing as evidence. There is such a thing as reason. And it's almost as if all this has been thrown up in the air for the sake, frankly, of earning millions of dollars. And I think we should be more upset about it than we are. Not about the film, not about the theories. We shouldn't be threatened. There's nothing in the Da Vinci Code which threatens anybody, should threaten the church and should threaten Christians. But the marketing strategy is cynical, and I think we should be speaking up about it.
So finally, Austin, when all the hoo-ha has died down in a few months' time, what do you think is the lasting lesson really for the Catholic Church here?
Well, it's been, for me, a very interesting experiment. Our whole strategy has not been to call for boycotts and protests, because we think that's just doing Sony Pictures a favour, and it suggests to people that there's a reason to be threatened. And it seems to me that falls straight into the trap laid for the church by Dan Brown in the book itself, which is that the church is defensive because it's got something to hide. And, you know, we do need to reflect on how, as a church, we respond to what we regard as sacrilegious or blasphemous or disrespectful. I don't think it's right to react indignantly and defensively in a society where freedom of speech and artistic freedom are held up. I think these things are being abused by films such as Da Vinci Code, but it doesn't help for us to scream and wave placards, because then the sympathy shifts from us then onto the, in this case, Sony Pictures. It was put very well to me by the worldwide architect of the Opus Dei, I think, remarkable communication strategy, Juan Manuel de Mora, in Rome a few weeks ago. He said, look, we're the blonde girl in the King Kong film. If we start firing on the ape, then sympathy shifts from the blonde girl to the ape. And I think we saw that very much with the Muslim protests at the Danish cartoons. Initially, we were sympathetic to Muslims, but when we saw those terrible violence around the world, you know, frankly, we started to get defensive and say, well, hang on, we live in a free society, how dare they? And I think we need, as a church, to reflect on where public sympathy lies, where the victim is. And the lesson I've drawn from all of this, because I think we've had a very successful strategy with the Da Vinci Code response group, I think it's worked extremely well. We've been part of the national conversation. We've been out there talking about Jesus and the Gospels and how they were put together. And look, that's the important thing. Where you have a conversation, the church has to be a part of it. If you either condemn and call for boycotts, or you sit back and you say, well, it's not fiction, it's just fiction, let's not take it seriously, either of those responses excludes you from the conversation, and we need to be part of that conversation, because, goodness me, people out there are, after all, hungering for these things. I mean, part of the reason why Da Vinci Code has been so successful is that it is, of course, about the figure of Jesus and the church. People find that compelling. And I've been saying, look, the real figure of Jesus is so much more compelling than the suburban alpha male of the Da Vinci Code.
My thanks, as ever, to Austin Ivory, Director of Public Affairs for the Diocese of Westminster.